As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
We're about to, yeah, build up and put that DA through, and we can put another two or four units on there. And the minute we go up one level, yeah, we've got amazing views, and that will change, a $4 million investment to a $12 million investment, or wow. 10 or 12, depending.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with Sydney's top buyer's agent, Walter Nanny. We'll hear about the most rundown house he's ever seen, which helped him to purchase his first real estate business at 22, the lucky escape he made from a beautiful seaside location, and the surprising amount of properties sold in Australia that don't even make it onto the market. Nanny has been working as a real estate agent since he was 20 years old, after being inspired by the men he saw around him who owned up to 20 properties.
Started asking them and picking their brain and seeing how they do it. And along the line, I started seeing examples or opportunities. And I guess I'm one where when I see an opportunity, I don't like to let it go. And that's been a huge part of the success, and also something that I need to watch as well, where I've started to decline some opportunities because you don't want to get too big or too risky as well. So I've always been careful, even though I see opportunities. But I did start seeing some opportunities, and that's how we got started, and the rest is history, I guess.
He ran his own real estate business for 15 years before managing several Harcourts franchises.
We changed from being a company called Robert Andrew, which I was a shareholder of the group and a director, over to being, they sold out to a company called Harcourts, who came over from New Zealand, who are, well, one of the biggest, if not the biggest in New Zealand. And basically, they, after a year or two of running it here themselves, they wanted to appoint someone more local to be the CEO. And I was running the largest company at the time, yeah, out of all the offices. So they offered me the position, which I took up. And then basically, as far as what I did was I kept my business running whilst we grew the franchise business here in New South Wales from about five shop fronts to about 40, roughly 38 to 40, and then along the way there, I guess there was some. I did that for about 8 or 9 years, running that as well as my own, and then it was time for me to back out. There was change in management and changes up the top or in the company. And I guess that was partly when I really put the foot down, or probably a year or two before I left, that I put the foot down as far as on the property investing side, because I realized that I guess I needed something that was always going to provide for me. And I lost a bit of faith in running these businesses that even though I was a shareholder and part owner and all the rest of it, it needed a lot of my attention and my time. And I guess you could say that I was disappointed with the outcome after running businesses for 20 years. I thought, you know what, it's not, I didn't think that it was what it was going to provide for me and my family, I guess, the way that I thought it would for the rest of our lives. And so that's where I really turned to property investing and thought, nah, this is the way it's got to be. I've got to really focus on that. And that's what I did for the next 7 or 8 years. I owned three properties up to that point. And that was funny enough, I had one of those reminders on Facebook come up with, you know, the old photos that says, hey, it's been, you know, 7 years today. And that was an old photo from, I think, a year or two before I left that company. So I'd say, yeah, 7 or 8 years ago is when I realized and really put the foot down. And I bought, well, there you go, 7 years ago, I bought a building of 4 units in Bondi. And that's when I wanted to basically hit it big and do something that was going to, I guess, be a big goal for me to chew over the next 10 years. And I wasn't wrong, but it was also, yeah, it's also going to give me the opportunities to really accelerate my goals and my plans.
His journey into real estate started with a then 12-year-old brick veneer house that was the epitome of the worst house on the best street.
It was just the most rundown house you've ever seen. So that, you know, they had 12 cats living there, and you know, and it was just the wrong people with the right house. And the price had been reduced because no one could sell it back then from 120, 130 down to 99, 950, I think. And so I offered them 90. I think they didn't take it, and then we bought it for 95. And the way that worked is that I, you know, as a young man, I didn't have enough for a deposit. I just bought my, you know, brand new Commodore, because that's what you do when you're 20. Yeah, and I thought that was the answer to all my problems. and it was the answer to some problems back then, but not all of them. But I convinced my parents. It took a bit of work, but I know I convinced Mum, and Dad took a bit of work after that, to use their equity and to go halves with me. And you know, initially Dad didn't want to borrow it, but then I said, hey, look, the way we'll do it is I'll do all the renovations and whatever else, and then we'll just sell it. And then I reckon this thing will be worth $150,000, and we'll get our $50,000. And they had a mortgage of $75,000, which is, mortgage of $60,000. Their home was worth $75,000, is what they paid for it after the deposit and so forth. They owed $60,000. And basically they were faced with a 25-year mortgage, you know, and I said, well, that's crazy. What you want to do is we'll do this, and I'll give you the $25,000, and that'll cut half of it off, you know. And so we did it, and within 6 months I completely renovated it with some friends and friends of friends and tradies. And instead of selling it, we decided to refinance against it because I got a very good broker. And so we still managed to refinance and pull out our money, and we got roughly $25,000 each, and I bought my first real estate business at the age of 22, and with that money, and they actually paid, you know, $20,000 off their mortgage, which is great. So off the back of that, we did it again a year later, and we did another place for $88,000 we paid, and then that was worth about $130,000, $140,000 by the time I renovated it. And then the third property I bought off the equity that we then had was a block of land down the south coast in a place called Ostermere, just before Wollongong, and that was to build my dream home. So it wasn't all about investing at that point. I thought, nah, now it's time to, do the thing and all the rest of it. But then I realised that wasn't, well, my relationship didn't work out for one, and secondly, it wasn't where I wanted to be, and it wasn't a thing. So I decided to eventually sell that, and I got very lucky that it was a bit of a boom period. So even though I held on to it for 2 or 3 years, I managed to make $100,000 on it before I sold it, because that block could have cost me a lot of money. So that was a very lucky escape.
This was going back to at least the 90s, I assume?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I started real estate in 93, I think, yeah, 94. And so yeah, that was probably 95, 96. And
a lot of changes happened, obviously, around the New South Wales area?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there is a funny thing though is, I mean, I still do a lot of, yeah, speaking gigs and seminars about property investing, and the principles are all the same. And I meet a lot of people that have a lot of equity in their homes that are in their 40s and 50s, and they have teenage or 20-year-old kids. And I always talk to them about that story, because I think, you know, it not only set me up, but it's since have set up my whole family, not just my mum and dad, but my sister as well, you know, where we own a lot of property, all of us together. So that's been a huge part of our strategy.
Nanny and his wife worked together to form the Property Dream Team.
My wife and I work together. My wife does all the searching as far as, you know, whether it's realestate.com domain, and we find a lot of off-market and pre-market opportunities as well. Like my phone's been going crazy this morning because agents are actually back now from holiday, so they've listed all these properties and saying, hey, here's all the properties. So I'm on the phone most of the day. I'm on the phone to new potential clients and meeting with new potential clients, because I do, in that, they get, you know, we do a whole hour of, I guess, strategy sessions where I deal with a lot of investors. Also, you know, home buyers who want to buy their own home, but I tend to specialize more in investors. So that requires planning out a strategy. So I teach them a strategy where we're able to sit down and go, cool, so that takes about an hour. And then the other things I do is I look at a lot of property. And my weeks are sort of break up into, I do weeks where on a, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm looking at a lot of off-market and pre-market properties. On a Thursday, Saturday, I'm looking at all the on-market stuff. And I'm doing, I guess, on night times, we're doing a lot of auctions, and on Saturdays as well. So that's kind of the week, the way it splits up, I guess. I think what a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't know either when I was running my own real estate business, is that about 40% of properties that get sold in Australia don't hit the market. So they're either sold as a, so they were about to hit the market, they're a pre-market opportunity where the agent says, well, we'll put the feelers out to buyer's agents and my small database before we actually hit the market. So in other words, yeah, they're about to come on the market next week, but they'll say, hey, Walt, we're getting 10 people through. Do you want to come through? I say, yep. So we go through, and if it's a match and my buyers like it, we buy it. And so a lot of properties get sold that way. And part of the reason they do that is just to get a good feel for, especially the agents want to know what they should be quoting for that property. So getting 10 people through, they get a bit of a feel so that it's a soft launch, I guess. And then there's complete off-market opportunities. And what they are is that there's a lot of people who don't want to hit the market because, they save a lot of money in marketing. Mm. So there's, you know, a $5,000 to $10,000 saving depending on the budget or the price of their home. The other reason they do that is they don't want all these people trampling through their home. They don't want the neighbors to know. So there's a whole range of reasons. But overall, personally, I mean, I love all the pre-market properties. They're great opportunities because the vendor is motivated to sell. We're just getting in before anyone else. Mm. The off-market opportunities, I like probably 30 or 40% of those, whereas 60 to 70% of them are overpriced. The vendor's not motivated, and so you've got to just sort out through those opportunities a bit, be a bit more careful. But they're at the moment, as a company that I work for, Cohen Handler, who are the biggest agents in Australia, we're buying 43% currently off and pre-market. So that's huge numbers. I've got an offer come through today, and they went through the very first open on Saturday. The agent's a mate of mine. Look, my relationships are what is very important in the marketplace that I work in. And so, funny enough, I just bought off the agent in December as well. So hopefully we're going to do another deal today or tomorrow on another property that he's got. And it's, like I said to my buyer, 10 minutes ago, it's a quick game. So once we're in, and the less buyers that get to see it, the better. Mm. So even though this one wasn't pre-market, it was actually on the market, there are only a handful of buyers there, so we shouldn't have too many dramas in wrapping it up. And the job that I need to do, obviously, as a buyer's agent, is make sure that the value is there, that we'll make $50,000 or $100,000 on this purchase. If we can't, then we'll just move on to something else.
Nanny's number one priority is helping his clients purchase the right property. From there, his happy clients spread the word.
80% of our business is referral and repeat. So in the end, the reason I get referral and repeat business is because obviously people are happy that they've made money. And all in all, what it comes down to is my clients have to make money. So in other words, we buy undervalued properties. I can name on one or count on one hand the times that we've paid market price for a property, and it's only because my buyer, my client, fell in love with the house or the property and said, I just got to have it. I don't care what I pay. usually I can talk them out of that, you know. Yeah. But there's been a handful of times that they go, no. And look, they are extreme cases as well. We bought, you know, late last year, we bought a property for $6.5 million, and they said, we don't care, we just want to have this, you know. And I said, okay. So we didn't get much of a discount. I still think we did well. It's an amazing, you know, unique property overlooking Tamarama Beach. But it's not like we saved $100,000 or $200,000. In the end, the job is to make sure that my clients make money. And because, like I said, I deal a lot with investors. If we can't make money, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 on a purchase, then we move on to the next one because I know that I can. And so that already gives them a reason to use me. I mean, why wouldn't you? And you know, because obviously it offsets whatever we charge, and by a long shot. And basically, it makes sure that you're buying the right property for under what you should be paying, you know. And that's why people use us. The main reason.
His company covers the east coast cities of Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney.
The main focus, I guess, is still Sydney, in the sense that the company's got four or five offices in Sydney, so North Shore and West and Inner West and Cronulla and all those sorts of areas. I personally look after, mainly Sydney metropolitan. Personally, I do all the eastern suburbs and some of the inner west and inner city, but I have two PAs where they also run around to, you know, one's based in Cronulla, so all of the south end, and one's based in Parramatta, so all the west. And that works for me because I guess I've been around this game for a very long time, and so I get a lot of referral work and they want me to go all over Sydney, so we carry about 15 to 20 clients with the three of us, and we, that keeps us busy, but not, you know, I guess it keeps us turning over property each month and buying well.
He brought his longtime friend and mentor to work with him at Harcourts, who then encouraged him to set and achieve bigger goals.
He owns a very large portfolio, and he asked me the question, 7 or 8 years ago, saying, "What's your strategy with owning these investment properties that you've got?" And I said, I don't really have a strategy. Or I guess my strategy was that I keep doing what I did before, and just because I'd owned a home with my parents, I found that we're just getting ahead, and I could pay off my own home eventually. And that was it for as far as a strategy. I just wanted to pay off my own home. And he said, "That's good. You know, that's better than most. But it's still not, you know, you could do a whole lot more. I mean, you're a young man, you haven't reached 40 yet, and you could do bigger goals." And I thought, yeah, cool. So he asked me the question, and he said, "So how much money do you need to live on each year if you didn't have to pay your rent or a mortgage?" And first I thought, what the hell is he talking about? I have no idea. You know, I mean, we earn what we earn, but I don't know. He said, "Well, can you survive, or are you happy to be earning $100,000 a year if you didn't have to pay rent or a mortgage?" And I said, "Yeah, oh hell, that's awesome, because if I didn't have those expenses, then I could still travel overseas each year, have dinners out, obviously run your household, pay electricity and all the bills and food, and be happy days because I have a lot of spare time." And he said, "Well, all right, let's work on $100,000." He said, "How many properties do you need to own in order for you to have $100,000 worth of income?" And again, I thought, I have no idea. So we started working out of my properties what they're roughly bringing in per annum, and the answer was $25,000 each. So very quick mathematics. We went, well, if I had four of those, that would give me $100,000 worth of income per annum. And he said, "Yep, cool." And then he said, "Well, how many properties would you need to buy in order to own four outright?" And five, because you've got to have one to live in. And I said, "Well, I don't know. Is this a trick question?" He said, "No, it's not. But you've got to understand that," he said, "look, you've been around now for, you know, back then it was probably 15, 16 years in the business." And he said, "You've seen two boom periods, you know, two cycles of a cyclical marketplace. In other words, something that repeats every 7 to 10 years." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, every time it goes through 7 to 10 years, it doubles in price. So how many properties do you want to own in order to own five outright?" And I said, "I have no idea." He said, "Look, you usually double it. So if you want to own five properties outright, you want to be buying 10. So that basically when you go through one or two cycles, in other words, 10 or 20 years, then you can sell off half and pay off the other half. And that became my plan for the next, well, still living it, I guess, but my plan for the future. And I owned three at the time. Then we bought a block of four because I wanted to accelerate it. And since then, we've bought another block of units and another two properties. So we're sitting at about 12 at the moment, and we're looking to develop both blocks. So that'll end up with probably over, well, not probably, but over 25 properties. And the hardest ones to buy were the first, second, and third. Funny enough.
Nanny sticks to Sydney for his own portfolio due to some of the stories he's heard from investors buying out of the state.
A lot of people have moved or bought property in Queensland for a very long time. And when I say horror stories, not horror, but I mean, you know, only a few horror stories. The rest of them just is always decided to come back. So they'd always go to Queensland, always buy there, and then 2 years later they're back and made very little money. So that's been with me for now for a long time. So I never really had any, faith in buying interstate. I do believe in Melbourne because I've heard good stories from Melbourne, different times, but I've also heard some bad stories. I guess what I learned since then, because I started, investigating a bit more about interstate, because, you know, as I speak at a lot of expos and conferences, I hear other speakers speak about how they should buy in, you know, Melbourne and Brisbane and all that. And when experts sort of wrote it off last year, they were all saying, go to Brisbane. But I started thinking a bit harder about that and reading some more articles about it. And what it made me realize is that Sydney and Melbourne have the most population growth each year, led by Sydney, but followed closely by Melbourne. And as far as what creates a marketplace for an investor is, or anyone, is supply and demand. And the problem with, I think, particularly Brisbane and the West Coast as well, so, you know, Perth and Adelaide and so forth, is that they lack the population growth. And so without population growth, you don't have demand. And the problem then is that if you've got a mining boom, say in Perth, where it's led by the mining boom that ended and which was always going to end, then it means that you've got an oversupply. And that's what I'm seeing, particularly in Brisbane and now in Melbourne, that there's just an oversupply. They're just building high-rise left, right and centre. Even though they've got the infrastructure, the population growth doesn't keep up with the demand. The supply, and so that's the problem, and this is the problem that Sydney will face this year, I think, as well. That, you know, it always happens at the tail end of the boom. What finishes the boom is an oversupply, and that's what you're about to see in Sydney as well. But it hasn't been that case just because of population growth and the Chinese buying in Sydney has been so that the demand has been far outweighing the supply. And that's why I haven't and I don't see myself ever leaving Sydney.
Sydney properties are averaging over $1 million, but Nanny hasn't noticed that deterring people.
In fact, it motivates them more to come into it. Affordability till recently was there still, you know, around 4.5%. So it's still been fairly affordable because our wages obviously kept up with demand. Having said that, you look at Sydney, and I guess it's hard to just talk about Sydney because Sydney's broken up into three or four different marketplaces. And so whenever you hear reports of Sydney, you got to think, well, hang on, what's driving that? So you've got the east, you've got the blue ribbon areas of the North Shore and that, and then you've got the other tiers that are working alongside, and then you've got the west. So there's a lot of different marketplaces happening in different demographics. The other thing to think of is, you know, as far as putting all eggs in one basket, is that, you know, I've got investors, particularly one guy that owns, you know, 35, 40 one-bedroom units around Darlinghurst and Potts Point. And a lot of people have said to him over the last 30, 40 years, why don't you diversify? But this has kind of worked out for him, you know. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Exceptionally so, around that area.
Exceptionally well, yeah. And you know, one of my other business partners owns a lot of blocks of units in Sydney, all over Sydney, and that worked out for him as well. So, yeah, I guess I have living examples of proof of guys that have done it before, and that's where I'm getting my life lessons as well.
Coming up after the break, Nanny delves into how important his Bondi property is to him.
And also, I knew that if I got myself in trouble, I could sell off the other three properties that I owned at the time, because I'd rather keep a block of four units in Bondi than anything else that I had.
He shares the thrilling story of how he landed the units.
I rang my broker as soon as I saw the auction sign, because it was in 20 days. And I said, hey, what do you think? Can we get this done? And he said, oh, man, you know, I'll do my best, but I don't know. You know, I don't know if I can get it done in time.
He reveals the way he sees some people's approach to life and why it isn't the best way to go about life.
I find that a lot of people are more reactive to life and the world as opposed to proactive. And whereas I like to be, you know, I've run a business for a long time, so you have to be thinking about where you want to take that business.
And that's next. I'm Tarun Sharm, and you're listening to Property Investory. Hey, property investor, is your cash or equity currently earning you 1 to 2% per annum sitting in the bank? What if I said to you that you can do better? To find out more, simply register your interest to become a money partner at propertyinvestory.com. Right now, there are great opportunities in the property market, and I'm looking for money partners who want to invest to get a high return with low risk on their money for 6 months. Register your interest by visiting propertyinvestory.com. Nanny is cautious as an investor, which has helped him avoid making any major mistakes.
I think that the lowest of the low was probably that block of land where, you know, things didn't work out for me. And then I also found out that this land is sort of on a hill and it overlooks the ocean. Beautiful part of the world. It's just that because of that, I hadn't done any research. I mean, I was a young guy, and apparently there was below it, like in the ground, was like a natural water sort of easement running down the bottom and underneath it. And so it meant that for me to build on it, I'd have to really spend a lot of money doing that. So had I started, you know, I did get plans approved, but had I started to actually hit the button and build, that could have really been a tragic thing to do, because it, you know, it would have sucked a lot of cash and a lot of capital. Still to today, I still drive past that block from time to time, and no one's built on it. And I think it's because of that reason. Yeah. And besides that, there were other problems that, you know, even one of the neighbors had built his house on, was encroaching on that land as well. So it had a lot of challenges, a lot of problems that I just didn't see at the time and know, and did enough homework to, and I bought it. So I just saw the views of the ocean and went, yeah, this is beautiful, but had a lot of problems. So I was very lucky to duck away or get out of that. And it was because I decided I didn't want to live there anymore. It wasn't so much as a bad investment. And then what really cemented my decision to sell it was that I thought, well, you know, it has got these other challenges. Maybe I just get out of this and take my 100, which I thought I'd sort of make around 100 and run. And that's what happened. But besides that, I've always been very cautious. Like even when I bought the block of units in Bondi, I knew that that building has subsided, so I've had to underpin it. It cost me, you know, $60,000-$70,000 to do that, and that was risky. But I knew that it was very calculated risk, in the sense that I'd spoken to a structural engineer, and he said, yeah, tops $100,000 to underpin it. Not that it would be 100%, but it would be livable and you'll be fine with that investment. And I thought, that's fine, I can handle $100,000, you know, loss into it, because I bought it for a lot under what value, whatever it was worth. And also, I knew that if I got myself in trouble, I could sell off the other three properties that I owned at the time, because I'd rather keep a block of four units in Bondi than anything else that I had. The underpinning just means that they dig holes, they dig all the way around the footings, and they literally pour concrete into the ground surrounding it, so they give it bigger shoes, I guess. And they drill into your footings, and they put steel rods, and the new concrete attaches itself to give it just bigger footings. That's basically what it means. So it's now sitting on a massive ton of concrete that's sitting underneath the building. So it just means that it stops any more movement, because I don't know if you know, but most people don't, but all of Bondi and And a lot of the eastern suburbs are built on sand dunes. Yeah. So, there used to be all sand dunes there. So sand is great to build on, but the challenge with it, and these are things you learn along the way, is that when the roads shake because of traffic, we're on a main road, the road shakes, and if you're if there's water getting in because the people who owned it before us they didn't do any maintenance work to the block, so all of the stormwater and everything was running underneath the footings. And so you can imagine if you put sand in a glass, if you put water in it as well and shake it, you'll see that, you know, it all moves. And so sand actually carries vibration, and so that's what causes buildings or property to actually subside and move and crack. So sand is amazing to build on, so I've been told by a lot of engineers, as long as it's well contained. You know, if it's not, then it can just slide down like an hourglass, and that's exactly what happened.
And also Bondi has fantastic views of the ocean.
The good thing is, look, we're about to, build up and put that DA through, and we can put another two or four units on there, and the minute we go up one level, we've got amazing views, and that will change, a $4 million investment to a $12 million investment, or
wow.
10 or 12, depending. Yeah, and that just changes the whole dynamics of everything, and that's pretty cool.
His aha moment featured the block of units he had his eye on for a while, and he ended up bidding without having his finance approved so he could beat the boom.
It has to be the building, I mean, because that really changed our lives. So the biggest thing that happened there was that I didn't have finance approved at the time to buy it, because what happened was I was traveling a lot for Harcourts, you know, interstate, and I just got off the plane, caught a cab home, and I drove past, and I'd been keeping an eye on blocks of units because I knew that was going to be something that would really accelerate, you know, the portfolio and really get myself on the right path. So I was keeping an eye on this block and two or three others, and it had been on the market for a long time, and the market hadn't moved yet. My business partner and mentor at the time said, you know, the boom's coming in the next 12 or 24 months. And I said, yeah, absolutely, you know, it's overdue because of the GFC and other things. It just took a longer time to get here. So anyway, I saw that they'd slapped an auction sticker on this block, and I thought, oh no. I thought, I'm going to have to move fast. So I rang my broker as soon as I saw the auction sign, because it was in 20 days. And I said, hey, what do you think? Can we get this done? And he said, oh man, you know, I'll do my best, but I don't know. You know, I don't know if I can get it done in time. So we started working on the finance, and 20 days later, because it was all a bit complicated, whatever, he still didn't have formal finance, you know, or loan approval.
Oh no.
But I knew that I just had to go for it, because if it was a block, if this was going to go for under 2 mil, I had to have my name on it, because there was been no sales in the area for under 2 mil for a block of units like that. So if this was the opportunity, I had to do it. And I remember being at the auction, Damien Cooley, one of the best auctioneers, except this time he wasn't on my side. and basically, he said to me, don't go over 1.75, and I thought, okay, and it actually did, because I thought that I had it, so I had to just go a little bit over. Plus, I wanted to test him, make sure it was really good anyway. and so we bought it. And look, I must have, yeah, that was quite the morning when I woke up thinking, what have I just done, you know?
Buyer's remorse.
Absolutely, you know, boy, talk about, you know, so having that feeling, you know, I do help a lot of my clients, obviously, because I know exactly what that feels like. But I also know that it's been the best decision in real estate. When you say when everything fell into line, that's been it. Wow. I mean, we changed the rents from $400 a week on average in the two-bedroom units up to $700.
Wow, that's a big jump.
Huge jump, you know. And that's without a complete renovation. It's just that they're undervalued. The tenants have been there forever. They were just run down. So it was literally a coat of paint, new floors, without even changing kitchens or bathrooms, just tidy up. We really changed, the rents. Wow. Overnight. So everything just literally, like you say, fell into place. And we moved into the worst one, and we've only just finished renovating it last year, and that was probably the the hardest thing to do, to live in a half unrenovated place.
Yes.
But the rest all looked great, and it's been the best journey ever.
He ended up paying slightly over what he was recommended to spend, making the final purchase price at about $1.765 million.
An extra 15, thank God.
It wasn't
I don't
much,
think I had any more. And I thought to myself, I can cover that. If it comes down to it, I'll cover it.
Yeah.
Because I also got a long 4-month settlement. So if anything went wrong, I had time to either sell or do something, you know. So, so it was a real, it was a leap of faith, but it was a calculated leap at the same time, knowing that we had stuff to sell to make it happen.
And when would you say that was purchased?
That was 6.5-7 years ago now.
Wow. I'm assuming it's worth a lot more than the $1.76 million you purchased it at.
Four and a half, just got valued recently at, and that's without doing anything like any development. So that's the next phase, and that'll really change things.
Although he has so much to be excited about, the DA approval he's about to put through takes the cake.
One of the biggest challenges there is to work out, we've had a few architects come through, and believe it or not, so if you can picture a fully renovated block of units with a nice backyard, a front yard, and everything looks beautiful now, they're all saying to me, I need to knock it down.
Okay.
So I had to get my head around that, and I still am, to be honest, but the numbers are so good. We do knock it down, but it's hard to actually ignore that. So after doing all this work and doing a lot of it myself and having a lot of memories there and, just everything's got a story to it, to be faced with the prospect that we're going to knock it down is huge. But having said that, the money we stand to make, and that's where you need to put your emotions aside and say, well, the block's already set my family up, not just that block, but a few of the other properties. But the other block of units that we own is also on 1,000 square meter block of land. And we've recently, just late last year, we bought the house next door with another 1,000 square meter block, so we can develop that into 25 units. So,
wow.
I won't, but that's a long-term project. I don't see myself doing that for another 10 years. But to know that we can do that and that they're both positive geared is great, because it means that we're just sitting on a nest egg. So I guess it's all very exciting knowing that the future, whichever way we go, the future's pretty much, we've done the hard yards, I guess, is probably what you could say.
The only thing that was holding him back from investing was a lack of knowledge on what to do, and he's found he's not alone.
I find that with my clients as well, that there's a feeling that you've got to do something, but just not knowing what it is that you've got to do. And that in itself, there's fear involved and there's all different things that happen. And a lot of people, you understand that everyone's a real estate expert or advisor, in life. And the more barbecues I attend now, people will ask me because they know who I am, and they'll sort of go, hey, what do you think this year, or what should I do, or whatever else? And there's always, I start telling them what I think, and then there's always someone that will jump in and start to sort of give more advice, and the people around me who know who I am or whatever else might, they always have a laugh with me and sort of go or at me and say, everyone's a real estate expert. And one of the biggest parts of, I guess, what I've done and what really kicked me off was having great mentors around me. And those mentors have amazing portfolios. They're very smart guys who worked it out. And one of them always says, life is all about, you get hit with a challenge and you just got to work it out. And one of those is financial stability. And a lot of people don't work it out. So the word entrepreneur gets thrown around these days. My wife watches a bit of reality TV where everyone's, when they join, like on The Bachelor or something, they're an entrepreneur. But when they get asked, what is it that they're entrepreneurial about? Oh, it's just that it's who I am. Okay, but what have you done? And I think the biggest for me, an entrepreneur, is someone who's actually, worked it out as far as financially, and said, well, I've worked out how to make money without my time. In other words, my money makes me money, and that's the point. When that penny drops and you finally realize that in life you're either going to be a slave to your job which also makes it that you don't enjoy your job as much, because if you're a slave to it, you know, you've got to get up every day and you have to show up, then you soon realize that, hey, it's better to do something that I really love if I don't really have to. And that becomes really cool. So if you can work that out and realize that it's either you getting up every day and making a lot of money, or what's your money actually doing? Because a lot of people are sitting on, especially in Sydney after the boom, sitting on a lot of equity. And when I show up and I meet, you know, my potential clients are all in their 40s and 50s in that regard, and they're sitting on a lot of equity, you know, $1 million, $2 million worth of equity. Their money sits at home every day whilst they get up every morning and go to work, and they don't do anything about it. And I say, well, why don't we get that money to start working for you? And that's the big shift.
He extends the strategy that he uses himself to his clients and tweaks it to suit the individual buyer.
It's typically the same. It's just, I guess what changes is, well, depending on what they have and what their past experiences have been, and also what areas they're looking to invest in. Because even though I'll say to them, you know, I think you should invest here, hey, they've got to feel comfortable, and I can only advise or suggest. It's really their journey, not mine. But I know that probably 80% of the time they'll follow me and say, yeah, that sounds great, let's go with that. The strategy doesn't change that much. I mean, I think you can read a lot of books on the subject, and I have, and generally speaking, you know, it's all about being able to build a portfolio where you've got positive geared property sitting in it. In other words, not costing you money. Generally speaking, they're all interest only. And the biggest mental shift to get around your mind is that you're not actually in the business of paying off, you know, 10 homes. You're in the business of holding those homes, and what's making you money is the boom periods. The reality is that, yes, you can wait. You can do it, and there's two key things, I think, that have worked for me besides that strategy is that I fabricate my own equity by renovating. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that makes it so that I get more return on each property, and also it values up to buy the next one. And so once I've got something that's positive geared, I've also got a lot of equity in it, so I can then use that to keep going. So hence the hardest ones to buy, the first, second and third, but after that the rest become pretty easy. But we maintain a pretty high goals, like we said in the last episode, and a routine of each year we renovate two or three. We reinvest in it, I guess, and we're constantly adding more value so that everything values up and moves on to the next one. You know, I've heard other strategies out there, and some of them is to flip. But the problem with flipping property is that I believe you lose a lot of money in fees and costs and things, you know, and taxes. So I find that you're better off keeping that equity in that home and using it for the next one. The other part of that is that, or the other strategy that I've heard that kind of, well, it's been around for a while, but there's different people that have come along and revived it, I guess, is that instead of owning, you know, 10 properties and selling down half and paying off half, they end up owning 30, 40 or 50 properties. And what they're living off is just they buy them only when they're positive geared, and they buy them so that the money they're making is like, you know, $100 or $200 off each property each month. But if you've got 30 of them, then obviously you've replaced your income. The downside of that is that it's not for me, so I don't tend to advise it, because I find that it's higher risk, and I find that, well, you just don't have the equity that I've got. You know, like we're on 50% equity, 50% loans. You know, we've still got, you know, $6.5 million out there, but we can cash in $3.5 million.
Definitely.
You know,
or three.
Mm. Yeah, so that's the difference, and that's what I guess lets me sleep at night. That's the point. It only takes one storm to come through, and then you end up in a lot of trouble. Mm. And I know that there's a couple out there at the moment that are saying, no, it's all great, but, you know, they've only lived through one boom, and you know, there's a storm always coming, and you've got to that's what you've got to outlive. You know, any captain can steer a ship in perfect weather. You know, that's the thing. So so I think having equity and having positive geared around you, you you can't go wrong, but you've got less chance of going wrong, and you can always sell one to get yourself out of trouble if you had to.
He reveals how important his business relationships are in the Sydney market.
I'm amazed as well, because I thought the toughest time was a year and a half ago, when the market got really tough for about a quarter. And that was the hardest time, because we typically bring, you know, we cover our wage, you know, what we charge, and we usually double or treble it. So in other words, you know, we make them around $50,000 a purchase by buying undervalued. But look, we still managed to do it. They still exist. I mean, we just bought one in December where it was a two-bedroom unit in Bondi. We paid just over $1 million, $1,011,000. It's worth, it got valued, or the value came through and said it was worth 115. So we made 150 grand for them. They're currently going through a renovation where it'll be worth even more than that. So the properties do exist. How we do it, yeah, look, we're doing it every day. So our relationships with the agents are, you know, second to none, because they've known me for such a long time. I've known them. I've been a real estate agent for 20 years. So I even, you know, help them along the way to create deals and advise them and teach them and do different things. But the reality is that, I mean, we've got a great working relationship. So whenever they've got something, they'll share it with me and say, hey, look, I need to sell this for $1 million or 950, for example. You got to buy? And I'll say, yeah, absolutely. And we do a deal. And out of every 10 deals that I see at the moment, there are two or three that are undervalued. The rest of them are either, so five of those are on market and two or three are overpriced. So that's kind of the current scenario. When the market changes and it becomes, well, when it got really tight, it was, you know, only one deal out of the 10 that became undervalued. That was very tough. But typically it floats around those sort of numbers. And then if it becomes on the opposite, which Bondi rarely becomes a buyer's market, but if it did, it'd kind of be more balanced. So it might be, you know, five of them are undervalued and five aren't, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there are undervalued properties all the time. Not forgetting that the reason why people struggle to buy those, I guess, without us is that, second part of that is that you've got to actually recognize an undervalued property when you see it. And I see a lot of buyers that are my competitors, they show up and they struggle to, they hesitate because they don't know the market. They don't know what value when they see it. So whereas I do, and I know that that's under, that I can get a good deal there and I jump on it. I lived in the East now for 17, 18 years. So, and I've kept an eye on the market for that long, and I've worked it for the last 7 or 8 years now. So, yeah, you get to know it pretty well.
Are you able to share a personal habit that's contributed to your property investment success?
I'm competitive, but I like to get it right. And I guess as a habit, I like to know that I'm in a safe place. In other words, safety or security is a big thing in part of my world. So the habits that I run around my daily or weekly or monthly is I guess what we talked about before, which is setting a goal each year for the whole year and then breaking it down per month and or per quarter and per month and then per week. So I run a pretty tight ship and we're busy people. Both wife and I, and we just we get through the weeks. So every, you know, Sunday night, the habit that I have is that I'll sit whilst we're watching a bit of TV, but I'll actually sit and break down, and I'll reanalyze the yearly goals, and I'll break down to see what has to happen this week. You know, so I find that a lot of people are more reactive to life and the world as opposed to proactive. And whereas I like to be, you know, I've run a business for a long time, so you have to be thinking about where you want to take that business.
I think that's a fantastic personal habit that anyone can really pick up, because it's really just reviewing your goals on a weekly basis, not just at the end of the year or beginning of the year.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or not have goals at all, which, yes, you know, a lot of people don't. Yeah. So I hope my wife's listening.
Make sure to send it out to her after this.
I know. No, but she's been great. But when we first met, she, we only got married last year. So when we first met, she said, wow, you would do all this, you know? She used to work for a company, but I said, yeah, this is the way it runs. But no, she's been great. And look, I'll tell you what, I mean, you know, part of this is also having a partner alongside that is your actual partner, you know, your best friend, but also that comes along for the journey, because that's where I see a lot of clients struggle with that, because one of the two will be motivated to invest and to get ahead in life, and if the other one's not, it can can be a huge challenge. Mm. So part of that is making sure that your goals all happen together and you're aiming the same way, because that can be, well, a make or break deal, basically.
Nanny's recommendation for books on property investing is to start with the classics.
I haven't read books like that for some time. I used to read a lot of them. I know that probably two of the ones that really changed or got me on the right thinking was Rich Dad Poor Dad, which I know everyone talks about, but it's such a good book for its time that, you know, the principles are still there. I used to actually get up and speak about that book. That's how I first got started speaking, you know, about investing, because I thought, yeah, this makes sense, you know, like it's all about money makes money, and either that or you make it yourself. And I had a similar experience where, we're blue, we migrated to Australia when I was 8 years old, and my family came out. And for me, I mean, my dad's a blue collar worker, so, a tradie. So in the end, I mean, my rich dad was more my first business partner, who was my mentor as well, and that's how I learned how to invest in real estate. So I could really relate to that book, and I still can. And then there's The Richest Man in Babylon was probably another one that also helped me recognize that if you got to pay yourself first, and the moral of that book is that basically, yeah, you've got to invest and put money aside so that it money again makes money, same principle, and it just accumulates. And if you don't do that, then you're doing yourself an injustice. So once you get your head around things like that, they can change your perception, and it's part of the journey. And I think, especially if you're starting out and want to get your hands on a good book, I think that'd be great. And look, I haven't read them in a long time, so even when you ask me, I've got to think back, right? but it's funny how they stick in your mind. You can quickly just go, oh, hang on a minute. But the principles are in your head, basically. That's the point.
Thank you to Walter Nanny, our guest on this episode of Property Investory. And if you love the show and are ready to get serious about investing your money to get a low risk, high return, then SMS me your name and email address on 04998810 40 to become a money partner. Right now, there are great opportunities in the property market, and I'm looking for money partners who want to invest their money for a short 6 months. To register interest, text me your name and email address on 04998810 40.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.